Welcome to the latest installment of the Science Progress interview series. Joining me now is David Goldston, the former staff director of the U.S. House Science and Technology Committee and a current scholar in residence at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. Goldston?
Yep.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure.
So last weekend at an American Association for the Advancement of Science conference on science policy, you explained to graduate students that our tools for doing science and technology policy are impoverished. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think there's just some very basic questions in science policy that we don't really have enough information to answer. What's the optimal size of the system? Are there problems with having a system that's too large that becomes unsustainable and that then can sometimes demoralize its participants? What are the best ways we can promote innovation? What are the links between K-12 education and college education and the functioning of the economy? All the sorts of basic questions that really underlie science policy and that we answer by a mix of sort of faith and sketchy, incomplete understandings from policy studies all could use deeper probing.
I want to find out more about this scenario of what you call unsustainable investment into research institutions. What is this scenario that you're thinking of, and what are the risks that you believe are so significant?
Well, let me start by saying I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be putting in more money into R&D than we are right now. But there is a question of how large the system should grow, that we have a situation now where almost every college and university wants to be a player in federal research and wants to go after that kind of prestige and become a research university. Yet each research dollar produces more graduate students, many of whom then expect to be supported by further research dollars. And you have sort of this Malthusian situation where you could end up with the population of researchers growing far more quickly than any reasonable projection of the federal budget to support them could. And there certainly have been periods where it's obviously been hard for PhDs to get jobs, either in academia or elsewhere. We have the situation now with the doubling of NIH, where medical faculties grew very quickly, particularly those supported by so-called soft money, meaning 100% by outside grants. And then when the increases didn't continue, those people were left looking for funding for their laboratories. Now, I think many of us would have hoped that the funding for NIH didn't basically flatten out quite so quickly, but even with reasonable increases, it would have been hard for that many people, and for that matter, the number of new buildings that universities built, to be supported in the way that people had been predicting.
Now, stepping back for just a moment, these debates over science policy often focus on these questions of how much federal money to provide for research and development. Do you think these debates miss the point?
I wouldn't say they miss the point. I mean, it's certainly the starting point of any discussion is how much money should be there. I think, again, those debates are usually a question in the end of how much money is available given other macroeconomic constraints rather than a kind of analytical discussion of how much money do we need for the research establishment. The assumption is more is always better. And that's not a bad side to err on, but it's not analytical. But I think we do need to get beyond just having those debates to looking more closely at what kinds of things should we be putting our emphasis on funding. What can we do to make sure that younger researchers get funding? What can we make sure that some of the most exciting, innovative ideas get funding? Again, are there particular areas, whether it's energy policy or something else that needs a special focus? All those kinds of questions that get below and beyond the mere question of the absolute totals, we need to have those discussions as well.
How can we understand the nature of these specific problems that need attention? You said that climate change is an outlier in these discussions. It's kind of a special case. What do you think, what qualities characterize science technology policy issues in general? Or why is climate change an outlier?
Well, I'm talking about climate change as an outlier. I wasn't talking about the research on it. I was making
Sure.
a point about the way science and policy intersect. And most issues that involve science. Science is only one factor, not a determining factor. The primary questions that are being asked about a policy question are not and shouldn't be scientific ones. Science just provides the background. That's an important factor, but it's not the only deciding factor. What I said was unusual about climate change is that for a long time, the debate in Congress actually revolved around a specific science question: is anthropogenic climate change real? And there was an actual consensus answer from the scientific community, an answer that's become even more clear over time, that the answer is yes. And the debate continued, although this is starting to change, pretty much unchanged despite that scientific consensus. And what I was saying is any one of those factors is unusual. For Congress to be asking a purely scientific question, for the scientific community to have a clear answer, for that answer to not then immediately start determining the contours of the debate, all those things are unusual, and yet because climate is such an overwhelming problem, an important question, sometimes the scientific community feels or assumes that every question involving, every policy question involving science has the same unfortunate characteristics of the climate debate, when actually I would argue it's rather unique.
You also said that scientists sometimes imagine themselves as what you called riders of white horses waiting to be called upon to clean up Congress. Why do you say this is a dangerous idea?
Well, it gets back to this science and policy question. I was referring in particular to some of the articles that have come out since the recent election of Congressman Foster from Illinois. This has nothing to do with Congressman Foster. And again, I'm not suggesting that it wouldn't be a good trend to have some additional scientists in Congress. The more various, the more varied the backgrounds of members of Congress, the better. But if you read what the scientific community sometimes says about this, the line is, oh, scientists are analytical, scientists work with facts, and if they got into Congress, we'd have, you know, solutions to all our problems. And this is a little bit of a caricature, but unfortunately not much of one in terms of what people say. And most questions are not purely factual. Congress usually does have and actually deal with the facts at hand, but those aren't decisive. And so the notion that, and science is not the only academic training that enables one to think analytically. So this assumption that somehow if we had 435 scientists in the House or 100 scientists in the Senate, all our problems would be over is a fundamental misunderstanding of the policy world. And it's problematic because in addition to sort of creating unnecessary cynicism about the policy world, it increases the tendency for both members of Congress and politicians in general and scientists to try to frame every policy question as a science question. And that tends to both drag science into debates where it doesn't necessarily belong and also makes it difficult to discuss the actual policy issues that are before us because everyone wants to pretend that they're a quote-unquote factual science question instead.
Back again to the question of money, what impact do lobbyists and earmarks have on science policy and federal research and development funding?
Well, I think that I've always thought earmarks should be limited, and I think the fact that NSF and NIH have, National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health, have not been earmarked is certainly one of those agencies' strengths. That said, I think some of the earmark debate is overblown. First of all, there's an assumption always that all the money within science agencies that is earmarked, if it were not earmarked, would still go to those science agencies. And that's really not likely to be the case. I mean, these are certainly fewer earmarks would increase the pot of money available in general, and that could benefit science. But Congress is not setting up an agency budget and saying, X amount will be earmarked. Congress is looking at how many earmarks do we need, and then that affects the overall pot of money for all the agencies, not just the science agencies. There are certain earmarks that can be helpful. Congress may have ideas both in terms of local development and in terms of particular areas of science that agencies are not paying enough attention to that it may be worth pushing on, especially if these are programmatic I wouldn't call them earmarks, but programmatic directions. In other words, spend money on this category of research as opposed to spend money on this particular project at this particular campus. But I think, you know, science earmarks have grown and diminished as part of the overall debate on earmarks, and so that'll continue to be the case. I think so. I'd say earmarks should be limited there, but they're not the major factor in what's been happening to the science budgets overall.
This has been very helpful.
Thanks.
Thank you for speaking with us again.
Happy to do it.
Okay.
Thanks.